Earlier this month, President Bush made his final budget proposal to Congress, the first ever to top the $3 trillion mark. Bush's plan would increase military spending and restrain domestic programs, including Medicare and Medicaid. It would also produce a $400 billion deficit, and our guests Scott Biddle and Gene Johnson have a problem with that. As leaders of the nonpartisan think tank Public Agenda, they're on a mission to warn Americans of the dangers posed by the rising national debt, which now stands at $9 trillion. They believe plain talk about the budget crisis is needed to enlighten citizens and move politicians to act. Biddle and Johnson have written a new book called Where Does the Money Go? Your Guided Tour to the Federal Budget Crisis. They spoke with Fresh Air contributor Dave Davies, who is a senior writer for the Philadelphia Daily News.
Well, Scott Biddle and Gene Johnson, welcome to Fresh Air. You know, I've covered, as a newspaper reporter, city and state budgets for years, and I find that they generally have a requirement that legislatures and city councils pass annual budgets that are balanced. And while that can be fudged a little with a phony revenue estimate or tax estimate, you can't just borrow for operating expenses. The federal government is different. Why?
Well, the federal government does not have a balanced budget provision for a lot of reasons, mostly because the founders didn't think it was necessary and no one's gotten the votes together since to do it. But I think the main thing is that deficit spending has become routine in Washington because there is no actual requirement other than a general belief in good government to bring the budget into balance. It's the default setting to run a deficit, and we've done it for 31 out of the last 35 years. There's simply no strong political incentive to bring it into line.
Now, there's a view that the national debt and the annual deficit, the numbers are gargantuan, but there's a view that what really matters is not the size of the debt in nominal terms, but its size in relation to the nation's economy, the gross domestic product. By that measure, how do we stack up in our debt, and is it a fair measure?
Well, I think that, you know, by that measure, the debt is not that large compared to the economy as a whole. We have a huge economy. But if you think of it another way, we're now spending more than $200 billion a year on interest on the debt, and that's actually more than we're spending on the war in Iraq. So it's beginning to be a very large portion of the budget. But I think the issue is not that there is a debt in any one single year. It's the fact that it's become business as usual in Washington. And we have this huge debt building up year after year to $9 trillion. And we are facing down the road these humongous expenses for the baby boomer retirements and for Medicare, 78 million Americans who will be coming up to Social Security and Medicare benefits.
Let's take care of one technical question here. A lot of people say that when the federal government doesn't have enough money to pay its bills, it simply rolls the printing presses. It's a metaphor. That, of course, is not what happens. What happens is what? They issue bonds, right? Federal Treasury notes, which are then bought by investors, right?
That's right. And those are available for sale for anyone. At the moment, one of the biggest things that's going on is roughly a quarter of this is owned by foreigners. Japan, China, Great Britain, basically because this is a safe place to park their money. The problem down the line is some other place may be a safer place for them. Alternatively, you might end up in a dispute with another country like China, and it gives them the possibility of an economic weapon.
Let's pursue that for one second, because there's been a lot of attention to China buying a lot of federal treasury bonds. And let's say down the road they want to punish the United States for some measure, and as you say, they want their money back. Well, the fact is that what they have is a treasury note with a payment schedule on it. I mean, they can't simply demand immediate repayment. What they would have to do is try to sell that U.S. Treasury security on the open market, right? What happens if they do that? What's the harm in that?
Well, were they to try and dump their treasury bonds all at once, that would really provoke a world economic crisis. And I don't think, and most of the foreign policy experts we talk to, don't think that's terribly likely, just because China needs stable markets too. And disorder in the world financial markets doesn't benefit them either. What they can do, however, is simply slow down, because all the other world financial traders are waiting for a sign that China no longer wants to fund our deficit spending.
You say that you mean they slow down buying U.S. Treasury
bonds? They slow down buying more. And then other people also start slowing down. Interest rates go up, not just on Treasury bills, because the government would most likely raise the interest rates to make them more attractive. But the interest rates would probably go up for everybody, which means your mortgage would cost more, your car loan would cost more. It would hurt the economy across the board.
Well, I want to talk a little bit about how we've gotten here over the past few years. You know, we've been hearing about, you know, very troubling and large federal deficits since the 1970s and through the 1980s. And then in the late 90s, we saw the federal government actually begin to run budget surpluses. Why?
Well, I think it was a combination of factors, and it was really remarkably bipartisan. One was a booming economy, which helps considerably. Another was that the first President Bush and a Democratic Congress were willing to raise taxes to deal with the budget issues at that time. And then President Clinton and a Republican Congress were willing to stick to some fairly strict spending rules to control spending during going forward. So that combination of factors, that combination of bipartisanship and fiscal discipline really brought things under control, at least in terms of the year-to-year budget. They did very little at the end of the day about the long-term problems of the entitlements like Social Security and Medicare.
Right, and they didn't chip away much at the accumulated debt, but they stopped adding to it for a while. Now how did we get into the situation we're in now, where deficits have grown enormously once again?
Well, I think that it's, you know, in some ways it's really no secret. We made very popular tax cuts. They were broadly supported. We had expenses for the war in Iraq and for all of the national security needs after September 11th. We've added a drug benefit to Medicare. We have increased spending for all the popular programs. And, you know, there has not been any kind of political pressure to make the choices that would get the budget back in balance again. And, you know, ironically, this has happened when we have had a booming economy and when revenues to the Treasury are up.
Well, let's talk. You mentioned the Bush tax cuts, which you said were broadly popular. There is, of course, the argument of supply-siders is that cutting taxes, you know, empowers, you know, the entrepreneurial class. It generates spending and therefore boosts the economy, which in turn boosts revenues. Looking at the numbers, how well does that argument hold up? Do the tax cuts generate enough revenue to pay for themselves?
Well, you know, it's an interesting question because revenues to the Treasury were up after the Bush tax cuts. And, you know, the tax cuts do, you know, generate some revenue. The problem is they don't generate enough revenue to pay for themselves. And so that you have even conservative economists who've studied this, you know, coming out with studies that show that tax cuts pay for 20, perhaps 30% of the loss to the Treasury. So you still have that 70 or 80% to cover.
One more question about how we moved from the surpluses in the late 90s to the huge deficits that we see today. How much of the federal budget deficits that we are seeing today are the result of the war in Iraq?
I think that is one of the most striking misconceptions we've run into in researching the book. Certainly, we've spent a great deal on the war, but the war itself is not the cause of the financial problems. Since between 2001 and 2007, the Congressional Budget Office says we spent about $600 billion on the war on terrorism in general. That's Iraq and Afghanistan and everything else. Over the same period, the national debt increased to $2.3 trillion. It's certainly true that spending on the war has added to our financial problems. But the fact is, it's not the sole cause.
Let's talk a little bit about federal spending. One of the things that you do in this book is to break down federal spending by category, and you find that certain things surprise people about how their federal dollars are allocated. What is most surprising about where our federal checks go to people?
I think what's most surprising when we talk to focus groups about this is how little of the federal budget really goes to the things that a lot of people will pick as their targets for cuts. So people will talk about the space program or the endowments for the humanities and the arts, or they'll talk about welfare. And, you know, the kind of this farm subsidies is another one that comes up. And, you know, the problem, if you sort of add these programs all together, you're really getting less than 5% of the budget. The big expenses are on Social Security, on Medicare, on defense, and on interest on the debt.
And you point out that a lot of the things that really tick people off, things like farm subsidies, I mean, in fact, you have one case in the book of a guy who has an asphalt lot behind him, his house, and he's paid not to grow rice on there, which he never intended to do, and various other outrages don't add up to a lot of money, but you say they're important nonetheless. Why?
The importance of waste and fraud and pork barrel spending and earmarks and all these kind of extremely frustrating things about the federal budget isn't that they add up to a lot, as you said. The most aggressive definition of earmarks I have seen is about $1.6 billion in the total budget. The budget for the coming year will probably be $400 billion in deficit. So you don't balance the budget by getting rid of that. The real problem with that is trust. This is what makes people cynical about the federal government and how federal spending is allocated. When we've done focus groups on the federal budget at Public Agenda, what we found is once people understand the problem, they're willing to consider making sacrifices. They're willing to consider changes in benefits, changes in taxes to solve the problems. But they won't make those sacrifices if they think the money's going to be wasted.
We're speaking with Scott Biddle and Gene Johnson. Their new book is Where Does the Money Go? Your Guided Tour to the Federal Budget Crisis. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, our guests are Scott Biddle and Gene Johnson. They're both affiliated with the nonpartisan website Public Agenda Online, and they've written a book. It's a new guided tour to the federal budget crisis called Where Does the Money Go? Well, let's talk about Social Security and Medicare, which is the really, really big looming problem for the federal deficit. And in a snapshot, how big is the problem? How quickly does it descend upon us? And what do we do about it?
Well, you know, it's interesting because we often talk about Social Security and Medicare as if they are the same. And in fact, they are quite different. And Medicare is already in trouble financially. And it's in trouble financially because it's set up a little differently. But the major problem is that healthcare costs are going up so rapidly. Already that program is facing enormous strain.
The Medicare really brings these two problems together. One is the 78 million baby boomers, and the other is healthcare costs, which are skyrocketing in any case, just throughout the national healthcare system. So when you bring these together in Medicare, you end up with something that is actually much, much worse than Social Security in terms of its impact on the budget. If you project out the obligations, as the government auditors have done, over the next, 75 years or so, you're talking about $32 trillion in Medicare obligations compared to $6.5 trillion for Social Security. Or to put it another way, if you wanted to fix this and you could raise taxes or cut benefits any way you wanted, to put Social Security in balance for another 75 years, you could raise taxes by 16%, or you could cut benefits by 13%, or some combination in between. Again, politically, could you do that? That's another question. To fix Medicare for 75 years, you'd have to raise taxes 122% or cut benefits in half. I think that gives you an idea of how much larger the Medicare problem is.
As somebody who considers myself a pretty informed citizen, and I've actually, as a reporter, covered budgets in state and local governments, I have to say that I find the federal budget process utterly bewildering. I mean, you know, continuing resolutions and 13 different budget bills that are introduced and debated separately. Am I wrong, or is it the mess that it appears to be to me?
Oh, you're not wrong. It is an extremely complicated process. The president submits a budget request. Congress then passes its own budget resolution. Neither of those necessarily are reflected in the 13 different spending bills. The 13 different spending bills do not necessarily factor in Social Security and Medicare, which are running on autopilot. We actually, in the book, looked at a few other countries and different ways they go about this. New Zealand works with a system of budget targets that are set. So does the Netherlands. New Zealand actually has a remarkable system where government auditors put out estimates of the financial impact of campaign promises made by the various parties during the election.
Wow, that would be a shock.
Which I'm not sure how that would actually work in practice here. But there are different structural ways of going about this that could make the system a little more rational.
I think the other part of it, there are all these kind of structural ideas. But on the other hand, not so long ago, within memory of most of us, our political memories, there were bipartisan deals on the budget. And there were agreements that the parties got together, where the administration and the Congress got together and decided to try to get a more fiscally responsible plan for the future. And there's no reason that if the American people want that and start asking tough questions, we can't get back to that kind of state of mind.
Well, Scott Biddle and Gene Johnson, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
Thank you.
Scott Biddle and Gene Johnson are the authors of Where Did the Money Go? Your Guided Tour to the Federal Budget Crisis, and they're executive vice presidents of the think tank Public Agenda. They spoke with Fresh Air contributor Dave Davies, a senior writer for the Philadelphia Daily News.